permit.
You know, the fact is you get to meet the ranchers and talk to them and ask them about these cows, and they're explaining what's happened here in the past and the old homesteads, and that's what I enjoy more than the birds.
2% of people live on the land now as ranchers or farmers. I think a lot of these people really appreciate being out in the country and being part of this lifestyle.
All I want to be known for was just a cowboy that raised good black cattle. And now they call me the bird guy.
I'm Jared Beaver, assistant professor and extension wildlife specialist at Montana State University. My work focuses on identifying and improving conservation efforts in areas where people and wildlife share the landscape. Place many folks call the working wild.
And I'm Hallie Mahold, Chief Programs Officer at Western Landowners Alliance, a network of landowners, managers, and partners dedicated to keeping the working lands of the American West whole and healthy for the benefit of both people and wildlife.
And today on Working Wild U, we're returning to the high plains of eastern Colorado to learn how a small ranching community transformed a migratory bird's imperiled status from threat to opportunity.
Our show continues after the break.
If you're enjoying Working Wild U, consider leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts. We would love to hear from you. And be sure to subscribe to Working Wild U wherever you listen to podcasts. Thanks. Now back to the show.
Let's talk about Carvel, Colorado and the Plover Festival. So Carvel, it's a really small ranching community on Colorado's High Plains, about 2 hours from the Front Range. And residents there joke about their home being 50 miles from anywhere. There's not a grocery store, no gas station, lots of just big open space. But there is a K-12 public school.
And there's the Carvel Community Center, a simple building clad in white vinyl, which serves as the base of operations for the Mountain Plover Festival.
And most of the festival weekend is actually spent in a school bus, making stops all around the area to look for burrowing owls, eagles, falcons, and so many other species. And, of course, mountain plovers.
How did this little ranching community, 50 miles from anywhere, come to invite people from all over to come birding on their private lands? It's not like every community invites people in to see rare species for a weekend. So we sent out producer Zach Altman to the Mountain Plover Festival to find out.
It's 6 a.m. and I'm in a school bus full of birders. We're headed down a bumpy dirt road, hoping to find some plovers today.
So researchers in the early aughts are thinking about listing this bird as an endangered species. So they start having to do research.
One thing. Oh, on the left.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Nice.
Put
your antelope kicks. Oh. Please, if you see any large mammals, you always feel free to interrupt me. Except cattle. Don't interrupt any cattle.
That's Katie Merriweather, our tour guide for the weekend. She grew up on a ranch near Carvel and now works in the area as a private lands wildlife biologist for Bird Conservancy of the Rockies. In fact, her dad, Dan Merriweather, is the president of the Carvel Community Alliance. We'll meet Katie later on, but right now, we're headed for our first stop of the day, Weiniger Davis Ranch.
Which is a pretty special place, it turns out. Because the story of the Carvel Mountain Plover Festival begins with a man named Russell Davis.
I'm Russell Davis. I am president of Weiniger Davis Ranch. We're cow-calf operation. We're running about 500 head of pairs. And we're in the livestock business. And I discovered that I had a bird on the ranch that Fish and Wildlife Service took some real interest in, and it's changed my life in a good way.
Back in 2001, Russell stepped outside and saw something strange on one of his pastures, a Toyota.
Well, if you know anything about our country, cow country, eastern Colorado, you don't see too many Toyota pickups. And then the next thing I see is a young lady walking toward me in a pair of khaki shorts and a fisherman's cap with a pair of binoculars around her neck in the middle of my prairie dog habitat. And I thought, what in the world is going on? And so I introduced myself. And she was really excited. She said, "Mr. Davis, they're everywhere." And of course, you know, I'm thinking, yeah, there's prairie dogs everywhere. And she says, "No, not prairie dogs, mountain plovers, they're everywhere."
Mountain plovers? What's Russell talking about? Zach, you reported on this story, so why don't you tell us?
Well, I had never heard of the bird until I actually went to the festival. So visually, it's this little shorebird. It's got tan wings and a white belly, skinny little legs, and some black markings on the head.
So similar colors as the black-footed ferret. I'm picking up a color palette of the plains here.
Yes, and plovers are really cool little shorebirds. But what's a shorebird called a mountain plover for?
Yeah, the name is super misleading because they spend most of their time out on the plains. They nest near prairie dog towns and fallow crop fields.
And what's with the nickname Ghost of the Prairie?
That mostly goes back to their colors. They blend right in with the landscape. And when they sit down when they're nesting, they're practically invisible. I mean, I wouldn't have been able to see a mountain plover without the help of expert birders at the festival.
And one last question for you, Zach. Is it plovers or plovers?
Well, at the festival, people were saying it both ways, but I was surprised there wasn't a t-shirt that said plovers are for lovers.
Sounds like a missed marketing opportunity there. But it sounds like Russell wasn't familiar with these birds either, at least not back in 2001.
Well, I've been here all my life. I had no idea what she was talking about. We are 80 miles from the Rocky Mountains. This mountain, whatever thing it is that I have here on this ranch, either I'm having a dream and this is not real, or she has no idea what she's talking about. So all this was going through my mind, and I said, "Well, what is the significance of that?" And she said, "Well, Fish and Wildlife Service has been petitioned to list the mountain plovers, and you've got them everywhere." The air went out of my lungs. The only thing I could think to say was, "Young lady, you need to get in the pickup and leave. You don't have permission to be here." I was pretty upset. And of course, she was really embarrassed by it, and she could tell I was upset. And she said, "Well, can I leave you a card? You can call my boss and talk to her." I said, "I have no interest in having any conversation with anybody. Whatever this mountain plover is here must be a mistake. I've been here all my life. I've never seen whatever this thing. I had no idea what it was." I said, "You just need to go." And, you know, I really feel bad about that encounter. These folks have been in the area for 2 months looking for plovers, and I didn't get the memo. I had no idea that this was going on. And she had come across a fence line. She's supposed to be working in a pasture next to ours. So that's kind of how my journey started. I left that encounter with that young lady. I was not happy. Here I've got whatever this thing is, and Fish and Wildlife Service is going to list it, and I had no idea what that meant. And so there was a lot of things going on in my mind trying to figure out what this is all about and what did it mean for Weiniger Davis Ranch and why me, and yeah, it was a lot of uncertainty for me as a landowner.
What does it mean if a species that's being petitioned to be listed under the Endangered Species Act is found on your ranch? And what might that affect as he thinks about his family and his operation?
and there's a gauntlet of species that are under consideration for listing at any given time by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And I'm sure Russell Davis isn't the only one that has these kind of questions. So we asked Lauren Connell, the regional chief for the Partners for Fish and Wildlife Program with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, because she was at the festival too.
There's a couple of reactions that are very natural when you hear that. You worry about your property rights, you worry about the future of your land, your operations. There's definitely fear about what a listed species could do for the options that you have and the accidental take of an endangered species.
Standing in his pasture, Davis learned two things that day. He learned he apparently had mountain plovers all over his ranch, and he learned that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service was considering listing the bird under the Endangered Species Act.
And because most mountain plover habitat is on private lands, scientists and officials needed landowner buy-in to conduct the research that would determine whether or not the bird should even be listed.
So this turn of events, it left Russell with a lot to think about. Should he close the gate, so to speak, and refuse to engage? Or should he let agencies, researchers, and conservation groups in? And if he does let them in, you know, what could be the potential consequences of doing so?
In short, Russell had a lot of questions, and these are big questions. And he just didn't have a lot of answers at the time.
We've never worked with government. I'd never had any government agency folks on the ranch, let alone Fish and Wildlife Service. I mean, we just, this thing was unheard of for us. And here I was trying to figure out, who am I going to talk to about what's going on here?
A few weeks after that encounter on his ranch, the phone rang.
My neighbor called me and said, Russell, we're going to have a workshop up here. We want you to come. And so I said, well, what's this about? And he kind of paused. He says, it's about the mountain plover. I said, Carl, I'm not interested. Why do you guys keep calling me? And he said, Russell, we can't hide our head in the sands on this. He says, we know the birds are here. We don't understand why they're here, why they're attracted to our landscape, but we need to allow the research to try to figure this out. And we're going to hold a workshop, and we want you to come to it. I said, Carl, I'm not interested. He says, we're going to serve lunch. I said, Carl, I'm not interested. We were homeschooling my son at the time, and he was listening to this conversation. And as soon as I hung up, he says, Dad, we need to go. I said, Kyle, I don't want to hear from you. He said, well, they're going to feed us lunch. You know, the least we can do is go and get a free lunch and hear what they have to say.
So after that extra nudge from his son, Russell attended the workshop, which was actually, it turns out, put on just for him. It was an effort to just start a face-to-face conversation with partners who would be involved in researching the plovers, including Bird Conservancy of the Rockies, Colorado Parks and Wildlife, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Partners Program.
As this lunch conversation wrapped up, Ken Morgan with the Colorado Parks and Wildlife asked Russell if he could come out to see the ranch. And at first, Russell wasn't so sure. You know, maybe there is no such thing as a free lunch.
Why would I have somebody from a state agency come in the ranch, ride around with me in the pickup? I've got things to do, cabin, it's a busy season. And Ken's like, Russell, I know what you're thinking. He says, I just want to see the ranch, I want to see what you're doing. And Ken came down and spent the day with me, got in the pickup. We did not talk about plover all day. He started asking me questions about you. If you're asking me questions about, I'll talk about the ranch. I'll talk about cattle, you know, and my family, everything that's going on. But meantime, Ken was looking not only at the cattle, but he was looking also at the wildlife values that were going on here at the ranch. We got back to the house, finished up that afternoon. We were sitting at the kitchen table, and I thought, you know, this guy's all right. And he looked at me, and he said, Russell, there's something going on here pretty special. And he says, whatever you're doing, and he made it very clear that it was whatever I was doing was the reason why the plovers were there. And that really upset me because, you know, all this time since that encounter with the biologist, You know, I'm thinking somebody had planted this bird here that, you know, and now it's my fault. That's why the birds are here. And I'm like, okay, this is not good. This is, you know, this is not what I want to hear. And then Ken says, you know, and that's a good thing, because what that tells me is, however you're managing the cattle, you're creating habitat for these birds. And it's working, and we need to figure that out. I begin to understand the importance that he was absolutely right. How we were managing the ranch was why the birds were there. And so I begin to realize that I'm not only a steward of the cattle and all the landscape, but wildlife was an important part of that. And there was a real education.
We talk about stories that are centered at the crossroads of cultural knowledge and science. I don't think you could have a better example here. The scientists are there because they need to learn the management actions that are going on, because that is why the birds are there.
I found that story really powerful. It even kind of gave me goosebumps, you know, that Russell's initially upset, like he almost feels blamed for the species, and yet through this conversation, and clearly it took Ken coming out to his property, sitting down with him and really talking about it, for that change in mindset to take place.
I kind of went from fear of the unknown, for a landowner not knowing where this is going to go,
right,
not having somebody to sit down and have this conversation with you, it puts you in a very uneasy situation. I mean, it's easier to just put your head in the sand and say, no, my gate's locked. You're not welcome here. I don't want to have this conversation. Yeah. And Dad raised us to embrace our challenges, sort of speaking. He says, you know, when you've got a problem, you come up with a solution and you take care of it.
So Russell Davis took a leap of faith and began doing work with outside partners to better understand his plovers in residence. But he says opening his ranch gate had a steep cost, at least in the beginning.
You know, the early years, everybody, my neighbors and the community, pretty much disowned me. Here I have all these government people driving in on my ranch doing this stuff. And, you know, it's interesting how in a small community, rumors just circle.
And Russell talked about one particular rumor about black-armed SUVs and government officials with machine guns driving around on his ranch. Wild stuff.
I grew up helping my neighbors and my neighbors helping me. That's how we survived.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, everybody quit calling me. Wow. And even with my family, it was a very difficult journey.
It's important to remember, too, that in small communities, it really matters if you're showing up at the post office and no one wants to talk to you. No one's calling you anymore to invite you. No one wants to have lunch with you after church on Sunday. That's a challenging way to live day to day.
This also just wouldn't live with Russell. I mean, he mentioned his family and that he had young kids. And I personally could not imagine my kids growing up and feeling that they're being looked at a little bit differently because of a decision I made.
While we often talk about, for example, the economic costs of stewardship, we sometimes leave out what some of the social challenges and social costs could be. And it's clear that in this case, at least initially, there was a big social cost for Russell and his family.
But eventually it looked like folks started to come around.
So the longer we stayed with it, my community soon realized that, you know, maybe this is not a bad thing. Maybe if we're going to be stewards of the land and conservationists, that we need to embrace this.
About 5 years after plover research began on Russell Davis's ranch, the community got together to form the Carville Community Alliance. Their first order of business, to keep young people in the community.
We were losing our young people out of the community. In this rural landscape, it's hard financially to pay a salary to keep a family on the place. And so a lot of the young people could go to town, get a job, make twice as much money. That's what Dad's doing at home, and it was just very attractive.
Yeah, and while it sounds attractive to young people to leave, it can be a real challenge to small communities. In many ranching communities in the rural West, schools and churches are the hub, the gathering place. And if school enrollment drops too low and the school closes, well, then no young families really are going to want to make a home there. So over time, that can actually mean the end of a small town.
And we brought the Alliance together with the idea, what can we do here to bring outside folks into the Carville community, generate some business, have something here for our young people to come back to?
And one night at a meeting, Russell suggested an idea to the group.
I really at that point did not know where the community stood on all the stuff that we were doing at the French. And when I suggested maybe doing a birders weekend, you could hear a pin drop. And I thought, you know, it's one of those moments that I wish I hadn't said anything. I better just get up and leave, go home. And there was a little lady, and she was here at lunch. She had a walker, Mrs. Clark. And she said, you know, Russell, if we had them in for the weekend, they could stay in our homes. And we have three ladies clubs, and we could fix some meals. And all of a sudden, the next 30 minutes, this chatter throughout the community building was, we could do this, we could do that. I scooped my chair back away from the table, and I'm like, what just happened here? It felt like there was a lot of weight lifted off my shoulders. You know, you take a small community like this, we're not, you don't share things like that, and all of a sudden here for 30, 40 minutes, we're talking about bringing folks in here for the weekend. We didn't look back from that discussion that night. So 15 years later, here we are, our 15th Plover Festival. And the community has embraced it and has embraced the whole idea of conservation, working with wildlife. All I want to be known for was just a cowboy that raised good black cattle. And now they call me the bird guy.
Our show continues after the break.
Working Wild U is a proud part of Natural Resources University, a podcast network delivering science-based information for your natural resource management. Other current network series include Timber University, Fish University, Deer University, Fire University, and Habitat University, available wherever you get your podcasts.
It seems like that focus of the Alliance on young people created some space for some creative ideas around how they could shift what may have originally been seen as a threat and a problem into something that could really support the community.
And to the point of trying to keep young people in the community, let's hear from someone who stayed because of all of this activity going around in her hometown.
My name is Katie Merriweather. I grew up here in Carville, Colorado. I'm a private lands wildlife biologist with Bird Conservancy of the Rockies, and I partner with NRCS in Rocky Ford.
You've kind of grown up with this festival. What was that like for you, and did that impact what you do now?
Yeah, it absolutely influenced what I did. We started doing it when I was in junior high school. The Plover Festival and the plover research in the area really brought in a lot of biologists from Fish and Wildlife Service, from Colorado Parks and Wildlife. All these folks were coming in and looking at plovers, and they were willing to take high schoolers around. I'd go out with folks from CPW looking at burrowing owls. I'd go out with folks from the Nature Conservancy looking at box turtles. Like, it kind of opened up that network to me. To have outsiders come in who really love what you've got going on, something you've never noticed, never appreciated, and then, you know, having your eyes open to that and being like, wow, you're right, that is cool. It did transition me towards thinking about biology as a career, and I really went to college sort of headed in that direction and wanted to come back and work on the Eastern Plains for sure.
Because I was just speaking with Russell, like, part of the motivation to bring this festival into being was to try to keep their young people in the area. Mm-hmm. And you're kind of a unique example of how that could happen.
Yeah.
More of a statement.
Maybe, I guess.
Feel free to respond.
Okay. Rural life can be a little bit tough right now, right? So it's, we don't have a gas station, we don't have a grocery store, and those are just daily essentials, right? But the thing that draws people back over and over again is the community. So the Carville Plover Festival, and more broadly, the Carville Alliance, is all about trying to reinforce that community aspect and bring the pieces that we need to the school, the pieces that we need to support the post office, because that's where you can do without a grocery store. You can go every 2 weeks, that's fine. You can fill up your tank before you leave town, that's fine. But the people are where Carville lives or dies. If we're all together on this, we all want Carville to succeed, then it happens, because we're supporting each other and working together. And that's part of bringing in young people. So if the community feels alive and supportive, then you can make a career out here. We got the school cook working at the Plover Festival right now. Like, she's a young person who came back, there was a job at the school, and now she's working with the Alliance. With me, you know, thinking about how the Alliance sort of inspired me to be a biologist, and then I came back and there was room for a biologist here. And some of it is just, you know, opening ranchers' kids' eyes to what they have.
It sounds like all the folks that come to the Plover Festival from out of town, they have the opportunity to really gain an appreciation for this landscape and for the people that make up the Carville community too.
So what's your name? Where are you from?
Brad Yuen from Colorado Springs.
Have you been to the Plover Fest before?
No, my first time.
Nice. How are you liking it?
Very well. Yeah, we're excited about the homestay. We stay at the Clark's house. They have a ranch and a farm.
Oh,
so
cool.
We went there yesterday and walked around and saw all kinds of farming equipment.
That's super cool.
It's so neat to come and look at the ranch and hear about the cattle and how much you eat. And they really have to sacrifice quite a bit to preserve the land for plovers. And Russell's really neat. He's, you know, he understands that he needs to sacrifice something to preserve nature. And it's wonderful.
And then there's Carol from Southwest Colorado.
You know, the fact that you get to meet the ranchers and talk to them and ask them about these cows, and they're explaining what's happened here in the past and the old homesteads, and that's what I enjoy more than the birds.
So here I have a festival where I imagine it's just going to be a bunch of folks that are really excited to go out and see this rare bird. And while that's true, it sounds like a lot of people are there to learn about the community, to hear about the cattle operations, to better understand working land stewardship, and the whole picture of Carville and the community is on display.
And all of this started with a little mountain plover, and now we're talking about community and the next generation.
And to the question of the ESA listing, in 2011, in part because ranchers like Russell Davis welcomed researchers onto their operations, the Fish and Wildlife Service determined that the mountain plover is not threatened or endangered throughout all or a significant portion of its range.
The things that they found were working generally were happening on private lands without any intervention by the state. Folks like Russell Davis are protecting it through grazing. Folks like the farmers are protecting it by having farmland, open ground. So those pieces indicated that it wasn't as close to extinction as anybody had been worried about.
So with the future of the mountain plover looking bright, officials and landowners sought to keep it that way.
Conserving the species then became the priority. So if it's not going extinct, how can we best conserve it? And that was through these relationships, these ground, boots on the ground, private lands, partnerships. The
beauty and the danger of the short grass prairie is that folks drive by it, right? So you never see what's out here. You're not out walking and seeing the wildflowers. You're not out walking and seeing the sparrows. You're not out walking and taking a look at these, you know, cool wildlife that's out here. So folks assume there's nothing here because it looks flat from the road, but there's so much complexity hidden in the plains of Colorado. And they don't get enough love, but they're so important for so many aspects of our life. I mean, not only are the ranchers here today talking about raising cattle, raising food for Americans and their family, but there's also farmers trying to do the best they can, maintain the soil, grow sustainable harvests. All those pieces happen on the short grass prairie, and ignoring that and saying, well, it's prairie doesn't matter, you know, is so short-sighted and unfortunate. It's really hurt us. But there's so much here, and it deserves to be conserved just as much as cool mountains or forests or wetlands.
And at last, during the Mountain Plover Festival in the little town of Carville, Colorado, there it was.
Does anyone need help getting on it?
A bird that most birders can only find right here in this pasture. For the Mountain Plover, home is 50 miles from anywhere.
Working Wild U is a production of Montana State University Extension and Western Landowners Alliance, with support from the Arthur M. Blank Family Foundation, and you, our listeners. This episode was written and produced by me, Zach Altman, with support from our hosts, Jared Beaver and Hallie Mahal. Lewis Wirtz and Jared Beaver are our executive producers. Music is from Artlist and Blue Dot Sessions. Special thanks to Russell Davis, Katie Merriweather, Dan Merriweather, Lauren Connell, Brad Yuen, Carol, the Carville Community Alliance, Bird Conservancy of the Rockies, and the Partners for Fish and Wildlife Program. And as always, please be sure to follow us on social media and head to our website to check out show notes and bonus content. That's at workingwild.us. And please help more people discover the show by rating and reviewing us on Apple Podcasts and share this episode with a friend or neighbor. That's all for now. We'll see you next time on Working Wild U.